From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes joins us for the first in a monthly series of conversations here on Lake Effect. Then we learn about the week in 1968, when entertainer Harry Belafonte hosted The Tonight Show during one of America's most tumultuous years.
They trusted him enough, or he, you know, demanded, probably both, that he could still be entertaining and get the ratings that they needed to get, while also talking about the serious issues of the day.
Plus, we learn what the Latino Arts String Program offers young people who are interested in music in Milwaukee.
Our students in the Latino Arts String Program, they would have the possibility of developing their skills at a very high level, but at the same time exploring the richness of the musical culture of the countries that we all come from.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll hear from filmmaker Yoruba Richin about her documentary, The Sit-In, Harry Belafonte Hosts The Tonight Show. We'll learn about the Latino Arts String Program and its upcoming guitar festival and competition. Plus, we'll hear a poem inspired by the streets of Old Milwaukee at the Public Museum. But first, we're joined by Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. The Lieutenant Governor made history as the first Black man elected to a statewide office in Wisconsin. Since then, this Milwaukee native has been working alongside Governor Tony Evers, advocating for progressive policies. Barnes is also considered a potential candidate in Wisconsin's 2022 Senate race, but we'll get to that later. Right now, I'd like to welcome Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm really, really excited to be here and be able to have this conversation with you.
I'll say I put a feeler out kind of on Reddit and a variety of other places, and the response was really impressive. A lot of people have a lot of things that they want to ask you. And one of the big ones was about vaccine distribution. I think it's top of mind for so many people. Speaking as a Wisconsinite who has had to deal with some of this, there's a lot of confusion around how these vaccines are getting into the arms of the people who need them. What are you and the governor doing to alleviate some of the confusion around this process?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. I spend a little bit of time on Reddit myself, but I'm more of a Reddit phantom because I don't post anything, I don't share anything. I'm just there to see what's going on. But I would say, given the rollout from the federal government, that's where we ran into our biggest problem because there were so many questions, there was so much uncertainty. In the same way that states were left to figure out how to manage the pandemic, how to manage the crisis itself was emblematic of the way that we had to manage the vaccine distribution. We needed a nationalized plan because unfortunately, the guidelines that states had made it a little bit more difficult. And we saw a shaky rollout because of the way that the allotments moved forward. But with that being said, we are working with not just the Department of Health Services, but we are also working with community health providers and other groups to make sure that we are able to answer any questions. We are, we've been able to streamline our rollout process into different phases so that people can know exactly where they are. And if you remember, at the beginning of the whole vaccine, when they were first introduced, we fell behind. And that was due largely because of what was going on with the federal government, how that dictated the state's rollout. And it's like not many states had it going right. I mean, save for West Virginia, most states had a shaky rollout because of uncertainty from the federal government. However, now we have a new administration. We have real leadership that's committed to making sure that we get doses in the arms of people. We've moved up, and you can say we shot up, and we are at number. We are of the best. And a week ago, we reached the milestone of 1 million doses administered to nurses, doctors, and other healthcare workers, EMS, and first responders, our loved ones who are in nursing homes who have been bearing the brunt of this pandemic, and people over 65. So I am excited about the direction that we're headed, and we have much better coordination than we had with the prior administration in the White House.
Speaking of coordination, especially when we're looking at Wisconsinites who are trying to access these vaccines, I think there's just a lot of confusion about where they should go. Is the state government involved in that process? Is this something that you can go to our government and say, hey, I need a vaccine. How do you help me?
Well, this is happening at the local level where cities and counties, people are able to sign up. They're able to first see if they are eligible or in an eligible group at this moment. If they're not, they'll be waitlisted and they'll be able to sign up to get a phone call when their time comes. And last week, the governor signed Assembly Bill 4, which will expand our vaccine efforts by allowing pharmacy techs and students to be able to administer vaccines under certain conditions as well. And the COVID vaccine registry is rolling out March 1st. So that anybody can go check their eligibility and schedule. And this will help streamline the process as that question comes up by, again, screening for eligibility, guiding people in the right direction, and putting them in the place to where they are able to make an appointment, and also reminding people about the second doses, which is critically important. You don't want to just get one dose and then think it's all done. You want to make sure that you get both of those doses so that the vaccine can take effect. And like I said, if you're not eligible, you'll be put on a waiting list and you'll be notified. And this will be piloted in a number of communities first and then rolled out to other local health departments who've expressed their interest.
You mentioned the disconnect kind of between the federal government and state governments, but there seems to be a lot of disconnect between the governor here in Wisconsin and the legislature. A lot of fighting that has seemingly left the state unable to respond to some major crises, specifically the COVID-19 pandemic. What are you doing to make sure that the state is responding to these problems, is helping Wisconsinites get through them, despite this partisan fighting?
Absolutely. There has been a huge disconnect. People were firmly placed in two different camps, and that is people who took this pandemic seriously and people who categorize it as a hoax. Unfortunately, the former president led many people to believe that that the virus was not real and it would not do the damage that it has done. We have crossed a grim milestone in this country of over 500,000 deaths. It did not have to be this way. And with that being said, the way we close that divide is for people to get involved in this process. We have made it very clear as an administration where we stand in terms of the need for us to combat this virus with everything that we have. And while we are waiting for the legislature to match that commitment, we need people to reach out to their legislators to ask what are they doing, if anything, and why not if they are not. Because the number of people that we've lost, over 6,000 here in Wisconsin, was far too many. Of course, it's a pandemic. You're not going to be able to save, you're not going to be able to prevent everything, right? And that's the unfortunate reality, but the numbers didn't have to be this high. And leadership starts at the top. And unfortunately, when the people that they put trust in with their vote begin to say things that are harmful, that are dismissive, that also that plays a big role in how the community overall responds. Because if you're trusting a person to make decisions that impact your life and they say, hey, this isn't a real thing, it's going to make other people believe it. And that is one of the most damaging things that could have been done throughout this whole process. And this is not a partisan virus. There were two Republican members. Well, one actual member of Congress and one who had yet to be sworn in who lost their lives because of COVID-19 complications. It's not a partisan issue at all. This thing has been ravaging through communities with no respect for political beliefs. And it is a shame that it has been addressed with such partisanship.
As we're looking at recovery and to some extent partisanship, we have these different programs that are meant to help businesses in Wisconsin, meant to help people in Wisconsin, the Payroll Protection Program and CARES Act. It's confusing who's in charge of what in each state. Can you explain how CARES and PPP work here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, our Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation has been in charge of making sure that not only are struggling businesses get the support that they need, but to make sure that it's done in an equitable way. Too often we see small businesses left behind at the benefit of larger companies, at larger corporations. It's not fair. We want to make sure that this recovery is one that will be an equitable recovery, or else there is no real recovery. And with that being said, it can be very confusing, but for those business owners, small business owners especially, who may not have all the resources, those who can't afford to hire a lobbyist or a government affairs consultant, we're asking you to be sure to be in close communication with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, because that is how we are getting our money out the door. It wasn't administered by the state, but the WEDC did play a significant role with the Small Business Administration to make sure that those connections were happening. So the WEDC is sort of a connector when it comes to recovery for our businesses. And we know that there were gaps in the program. That's why $125 million in CARES Act funding went towards the We're All In grants that went directly to small businesses. And in total, we spent almost $400 million to help stabilize the economy and support nearly 53,000 small businesses. And that's more than 15,000 farms and our lodging, hospitality, and tourism industry.
So when it comes to the state of Wisconsin, a lot of this is going through the WEDC, or what some people call WEDEC.
So yeah, WEDEC is the connector. WEDEC is the apparatus in which our small businesses will be connected to the Small Business Administration if they don't have that direct contact. And this is what the WEDC is for, to be sure that we can sustain our economy, specifically our small businesses. We're doing things much differently, but there was also CARES Act funding that was available for businesses, and we made good use of that money.
Taking a bit of a left turn here, this is the year that Wisconsin is going to be redrawing its district maps. And we know that these maps right now are gerrymandered. And recently, Republicans in the state legislature hired fairly expensive lawyers to help handle lawsuits that they must expect to happen once these maps are released this year. What are you and the governor doing to counter what are likely to be renewed efforts to further gerrymander the state?
And unfortunately, the Republicans in the legislature have had no reservation when it comes to spending enormous sums of money on legal fees, because they understand that what should be happening for the state of Wisconsin, they aren't able to justify it within a legislative chamber. And that is why they want to bring in high paid attorneys to try to make sense of things that don't make sense at all. And so the governor created the People's Maps Commission, and they are continuing to do great work. We know that in 2011, 10 years ago, we went through the same story. This time we're at least aware of it, because they hired private attorneys to rig the maps behind closed doors. In the state of the state, the governor announced that our budget will require the legislature to take up the People's Maps and prohibit them from destroying public records related to this process, because we saw that is what happened last time. The people deserve so much more than having to repeat these tired trends, than having to repeat these tired mistakes that also become costly mistakes in terms of legal fees that have to continue to be paid out to these attorneys who do the legislature's work in secrecy.
Do you expect a big legal fight? And how are you and the governor and the state of Wisconsin preparing for this fight?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, it's not easy because of the fact that they have been able to operate with these gerrymander maps, these rigged maps for the last 10 years. They feel that they are at an advantage. And in many ways, things do just become increasingly and unnecessarily difficult because of the way they act in governing because of these unfairly drawn maps. But with that being said, I think the People's Maps Commission gives us opportunity for the public to provide input so that the map drawing process can be more fair, can be transparent, can be open. And we fully expect them to draw maps that are probably even worse than the ones we have now. And we can probably assume that with the money that they are setting aside to go to court, that we are going to end up in court. And with that, it is going to be important for not just the people, but for the courts, for the judges to also be able to compare side by side what a map that was drawn fairly and in an open process versus what a map that was drawn in secrecy to benefit a political party looks like. And I think that, you know, a lot of us can see it, but it's going to be important for it's going to be important not just for the courts, but it's also going to be important for our journalists to and members of the media to get that information out there, because the people of the state deserve to see what's going on. And that's why we have the People's Maps Commission, sort of an open source process.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Now, the legislature recently introduced policies that critics say would add more barriers to voting in the state of Wisconsin. Is this something that Wisconsinites should be concerned about, or is this something that can ultimately be vetoed?
Well, it's absolutely something they should be concerned about. And I can say that the governor has also already indicated that anything to prohibit voting, he is going to veto. But I will mention that the fact that these things are even being introduced should scare people. You know, these are tactics to prohibit, to get people to stifle the notion, or stifle even the will of people to show up and make their voices heard. This happened, you know, again, 10 years ago after Barack Obama won. In 2008, we saw in the following legislative session when the Republicans got control of majorities of both houses and the governor's office, they implemented a voter ID law that was unnecessary. Wisconsin was known for having progressive voter laws. And I think that the fact that they see this past election, where their president, you know, did not win re-election, too many of them still can't accept it. There were two members of our congressional delegation that still voted to decertify Arizona's election results, which was shameful. And so this is the sort of mindset they have been led blindly by effectively a cult leader in Donald Trump. And now people are questioning whether the election results were real, and it couldn't be farther from the truth, because how did they still, across the country, they gained seats in the House of Representatives. They won two state Senate seats here in Wisconsin. So do those elections not count either? Or is it just the one that they want to call into question? And with that said, anytime elections don't go their way, they want to do something to disrupt the process or keep people from being able to exercise their rights. There's so many more things that we need to be doing to expand voting rights. And gerrymandering is a big piece of that. Again, they saw that their strategy of a very regressive thinking was not getting them anywhere, and they didn't want to change to follow the will of the people. Instead, they tried to keep more people from voting instead of doing what the people would require of them.
To your point, there are a variety of things that voting rights advocates have pointed to which could make voting in the state of Wisconsin more egalitarian. And one thing that stands out to me is something that we haven't had here before. It's called ranked choice voting. For listeners who are unfamiliar with that, essentially you vote for a few candidates in the order of who you'd like to see in that office. Is that something that Democrats in Wisconsin are open to, that they support? And is that something that you and the governor are interested in?
So there have been a number of, I think actually a couple of Democrats introduced ranked choice voting in the state. I've seen a number of states move in that direction. I can honestly say that I have not had that conversation with the governor yet. I have had a conversation with some friends before, just on the merits, but not necessarily if it's something that we should do or not. And I think that it's important for us to make sure that we retain voting rights for people in general in this state and expand voting rights, making sure that we increase access to those who have lost their rights, making sure that those who need to vote absentee will be able to do so. But ranked choice voting, it has not come up yet in a formal policy conversation with the governor.
So this last question, I got this question from almost everyone I asked, you know, what would you like to talk to the lieutenant governor about? A lot of people are curious if you're going to run for the Senate in 2022. Now, I understand this conversation is really in regards to your work as lieutenant governor, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that. So instead, I'll ask you this. What do you see as your personal mission as a politician? And how does that square with the work that you're doing right now?
I absolutely want to be effective. And the work that I do now in this office is informed by the work that I did prior to ever running for even a seat in the assembly. It was my work as an organizer, making sure that communities that had not gotten what they deserve can have a fighting chance. I think about those same issues being present today, and I think about the need for us to continue to work to fully fund our schools, to make sure that we are on the forefront of criminal justice reform, reducing our spending on the Department of Corrections so that we can put more money into communities, so that we can provide good paying jobs and healthcare to people all over Wisconsin, regardless of their zip code, regardless of their income. It's about opportunity. And I feel that the work that I'm doing now is solely based on working to provide opportunity in any way possible, especially when it comes to looking out for our future, combating climate change, and crafting an agenda to support working families all the way from Milwaukee to Superior down to Platteville, right? I think that that's what's important. And I want to be as effective as I possibly can in that regard. And I can say that we've made some significant strides since my very first election in 2012. I think we've gotten really far on the issues that have been and have always been important to me. But there's always the need to do more.
Do you feel like in your current position, you're able to do what you want to do with these issues?
I honestly feel that we've been able to step out a lot farther than lieutenant governors in the past. And that's just the conversations that have come to me. People will say all the time, we haven't seen a lieutenant governor be as active. And I think that just speaks to the governor and I, our relationship. I really enjoy being able to work with him. He asks me what I'm up to all the time and what do I want to do. And so being able to do things like serve on the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, the Health Equity Council, to chair the Governor's Task Force on Climate Change, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force. I mean, these are all just incredible opportunities for me to engage with people all across the state. It puts me in a unique position as well. I'm always wanting to learn more. I'm always wanting to experience more that this state has to offer. At the same time, I recognize that I'm still not the top guy. I have to operate within the parameters set by the governor's office. But the governor's office has set some very accommodating parameters for me, and they've given me an opportunity, a chance to be effective and to champion the causes that I campaigned on when I ran for lieutenant governor. You know, just because you campaign on an issue as lieutenant governor does not mean it's going to happen, because you can end up with a candidate for governor or a person who becomes governor who doesn't share the same values. And that wasn't the case with us. Fortunately, it's always a roll of the dice, but here we are, and we're able to lead with equity and sustainability in mind. And that's how we're going to move forward. I'm going to do as much as I possibly can with the time and the position that I'm given.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and taking the time to talk.
Oh, of course. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Mandela Barnes is the Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin. This conversation is the first in a series of monthly conversations with the Lieutenant Governor here on Lake Effect. So stay tuned. Coming up, Latino Arts is an organization dedicated to bringing cultural awareness and artistic educational experiences to young people here in Milwaukee. Coming up in about 13 minutes, we'll tell you about their virtual guitar festival and how it will connect students from around the country. But first, we speak with filmmaker Yoruba Richin about her documentary, The Sit-In, Harry Belafonte hosts The Tonight Show, featured in Milwaukee Film's Black History Month program. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In 1968, America was in turmoil. The nation was divided over the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, and a variety of political differences. And in the middle of all of it, a black entertainer took over the host chair of one of the country's most iconic TV shows. For a full week, performer and activist Harry Belafonte took over for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Belafonte was given full control of his guest list, which included Aretha Franklin, Paul Newman, Lena Horne, as well as Robert F. Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., mere months before they were both assassinated. A new documentary called The Sit-In, Harry Belafonte hosts The Tonight Show, explores the impact of this historic week in television. It's directed by Yoruba Richin and features Belafonte himself, as well as some of the guests he had on the famed Tonight Show couch. Richin joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about the impact this week of programming had on American television and culture.
Basically, Johnny Carson, who hosted The Tonight Show, recognized that there was a lot going on during this time, and he needed somebody who could take over and the show and talk about this stuff in a way that was entertaining and yet serious. And he chose Harry Belafonte to do it. From what we know, he was the one who made the decision. And he asked Harry to host the show for a week. It was the first time a black entertainer had hosted The Tonight Show for a week. There had been others, but not for a full week. And Harry agreed after some negotiation, and he had on this amazing cast of characters who came in. Everyone, artists, activists, including Paul Newman and Zira Mostel and Lena Horne and Diane Carroll and Aretha Franklin. And you know, his friend, Dr. Martin Luther King, and it was his Dr. King's last televised interview. And he also had Robert Kennedy as well. And it was a couple of months before Robert Kennedy was assassinated too. And so it was this very historic week where he had on these politicians, activists, really bringing what was going on to an audience, a wide audience. Remember at that time, there were only three stations and The Tonight Show was one of the most popular shows. So it was a very historic moment in television history.
Right. And Harry Belafonte also had control of the guest list for this week, which was huge. And your film refers to his bookings as spokespeople of the mood of the nation, which I think is just so aptly captured what that was.
Absolutely. And it really was about how Harry saw what was going on during this time. That's what I came to realize as I made the film. And, you know, the film also goes into who Harry is and was at that time, what a multi-hyphenate entertainer, huge star, and a crossover star during a time of legal segregation. So Harry, who's still with us, his birthday is actually coming up soon, is a phenomenal figure in both entertainment and in activism.
Yeah, and this time in history, you know, the late 1960s was also a time that showcased performers becoming activists, transitioning into actively having a voice and taking a stance versus previously in the entertainment industry, most would try to stay neutral.
Absolutely. And I would say that Harry was an entertainer and activist always. So one, I don't think came before the other. And yeah, staying neutral wasn't an option for many, especially African Americans, but for other entertainers as well. And I think we still see that today. I don't think that's something that's lost. I mean, one of the things I think about entertainers, somebody said this, I forget where it's from, but said, you know, actors, think talking about actors or singers, have an empathy. That's part of the job, is to have empathy, right? When you're trying to create a mood with your music and trying to tell a story with your music. And so I think when you have empathy, you see things differently and you see and you feel for the things that are unjust and that are unfair and want to speak out and try to change them.
And obviously Johnny Carson wanted to shed light, and the American institution that is late night TV was and still is very white. And of course, sitcoms of the time didn't reflect true American life and certainly not Black lives. So how significant was it for Johnny Carson to use his soapbox and kind of lend it to others to voice what he felt he couldn't voice, whether because of who he was, or do you know if NBC, the executives, obviously Johnny Carson wanted to do this and agreed, but did the executives, were they not as enthused, shall we say, or, you know?
Well, I think Johnny had a lot of, he had a lot of power. That's one thing. So he was able to sit, do what he wanted to do. We do know that the executive, there's a story that, you know, after Belafonte, after Harry agreed to do it and negotiated to create, to have, you know, control of his guest list, and he said, you know, he said he was going to have Dr. King on. And one of the executives said, said something like, well, you know, he's not going to talk about that civil rights stuff, is he? And Harry said, well, what do you want him to do? Sing opera? So there obviously was some nervousness, but they let him do it. They trusted him enough, or he, you know, demanded probably both, that he could still be entertaining and get the ratings that they needed to get while also talking about the serious issues of the day.
And with so few major networks on TV, how segregated was American media at the time? I know Soul debuted in 1968 as well. Was it already out before this week, or how did that intersect?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to mention that. One of the things that I learned in making the film is how segregated TV was. One of the historians, Dr. King's historian of Dr. King, said, remember, Dr. King was rarely on TV. I mean, it's hard to believe that now, but he was not on TV a lot. Having multiracial guests, you know, sitting on the couch, Johnny's couch, or interacting was very rare, was not common. I mean, we see it, you know, now it's hard to believe in terms of what we see on television. So it was a big deal. And Mr. Soul, I believe, came on after, debuted after this week, as did Julia, the groundbreaking show Julia with Diane Carroll.
That's right. So with your documentary, you feature, of course, Harry Belafonte himself, but also some of the guests who took part in that week. So what was it like for you to speak with them and, you know, to show Harry his guest list and be like, what do you remember about this epic week of television?
Well, it was a real pleasure, obviously, to interview Harry, you know, a real highlight of my career. So warm and funny and passionate. And then the other guests were who were still with us, obviously, were, you know, very delighted to take part in it. And, you know, it was a long time ago. So there was memory jogging that we had to do, show bits of the footage, you know, that we had. But that was, you know, totally makes sense. And it was, I'm really glad we got to capture a lot of the folks who appeared that week.
You mentioned being able to show some of the tapes, and one of the most heartbreaking things of this film, I suppose as a producer myself, but the fact that NBC recorded over their tapes and only 2 half-hour programs still exist of this week and some audio tapes, that's terrible.
yeah. And it was terrible. We knew this going in, but you know, you'll see what we were able to dig up in the film. How we were able to dig up these audio tapes that, you know, are really the first time they've been heard since, I think, ever, like heard publicly. So, yeah, that was definitely a challenge. and very sad because there's a lot that we, you know, a lot of those guests, we know they were on, but we are not able to, you know, see them in action.
Yeah, I think you still do a great job of tying together that week and what it means. And, you know, with this move by NBC, really opening American audiences to more perspectives, how did the Harry Belafonte week also open the door to make TV a place for more than just entertainment and escapism? You know, this proved that audiences are interested in real life and politics and things that are happening.
Definitely. I mean, I think that because those tapes were lost, you know, there was an institutional memory that was lost with those. Mm-hmm. However, he did create the pathway for this mixture of entertainment and politics in late night, which we see obviously today. And after Harry, the next Black, you know, host of a late night show was Arsenio. That was something, you know, some 30 years later. So obviously it didn't break down the doors, you know, that late night got diversified, but that's usually not what happens in Hollywood. There may be one thing and then silence around the issue for a long time until some other barrier breaker, and that was Arsenio.
It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, some of that institutional memory got lost, and Black voices in late night still struggle to take hold. So how do you hope that people learning about this week now, you know, either that weren't alive at the time or needed a reminder of, hey, this happened, how do you want it to impact them today?
Well, first off, I think it's important to know about Harry's legacy and who he was and the importance he had in both entertainment and activism. And, you know, late night, there's been demands for more diversity in late night. And hopefully this film will be another voice in calling for that, especially, you know, the times that we're living in now. We need more diversity. People get their news from late night. People get their understanding of what's going on in the country and the world. So obviously we need to have more diverse late night hosts who we can understand their perspective and understand their take on it. So, you know, this film, I think, is another voice, another cry for that.
Well, Yoruba Richin, I really enjoyed watching this dive into history, and I want to thank you for speaking with me about it today.
Thank you for having me. Everyone, I hope, will watch the film and enjoy.
Yoruba Richin is the director of the documentary The Sit-In. Harry Belafonte hosts The Tonight Show. Available to stream now through Milwaukee Film's Black History Month program. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Next, we'll tell you how Latino Art's upcoming guitar festival and competition has been modified to fit the pandemic.
We all know now, through this pandemic, just how valuable music has been for uplifting the spirit and just keeping people going, keeping hope going. And so this festival is as much an activity of hope and celebration as it is anything else.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. The roots of classical guitar run deep in Latin American music. The instrument first appeared in Spain around the turn of the 15th century and arrived in Latin America and the Caribbean in the 1600s. To honor the art form Latino Arts, a local nonprofit dedicated to Hispanic culture arts programming is hosting its 8th annual guitar festival and youth competition and concert this month. Dinora Marquez is the Latino Arts String Program Director, and Joan Ruiz is one of the instructors. They spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver and begin by giving a little background on Latin American classical guitar.
What happens in Latin America once it arrives, it varies from country to country, from region to region. And, you know, it becomes a huge part of Latin American folk traditions But as well, a huge part of the Latin American classical, European classical tradition. And so it is important to note that, because not only does it become a big part of it, but all the influence, all the Afro and indigenous influence that we steeped the classical traditions with in Latin America really come through from very, very early on. We can be talking Baroque music, and if you hear an Allemande written in Latin America versus in Germany, Germans would be up in arms because it was just so wild, we do definitely receive a beautiful tradition from the European classical, but in Latin America and with our Afro-Indigenous roots, we really do something different with it, especially on the guitar.
Yes, that's about right, that we begin around that time, and then we have the guitar Baroque, and then the guitar went through a lot of development as an instrument. And then it was not until Andrés Segovia that he began to modern what we call today, what we know as a classical guitar. But then during that time, there were many composers, even Latin American composers, that they developed an instrument in their own country. So yes, Latin American music has been a very big impact in the development of the classical guitar per se.
So tell me a little bit about your program at Latino Arts and then this concert that's coming up and how that fits into, your teaching philosophies.
Well, so the Latino Arts Strings program has been part of Latino Arts and the United Community Center now for almost 20 years. And the idea behind the program, the original seed idea, was to establish a program in which young Latinx students who may not have access to private instruction or conservatory work or private institutions to be able to study instruments, string instruments, they would have the opportunity. They would have a scholarship-based program that would give them all of those opportunities, private lessons, instruments, materials, small group lessons, ensemble experience, that they would have that. But they would also have a program that would celebrate and cherish where each student came from. So our students in the Latino Arts Strings program who study violin, viola, cello, guitar, bass, and a variety of guitar-like traditional instruments, that they would have the possibility of developing their skills at a very high level, but at the same time exploring the richness of the musical culture of the countries that we all come from. Now, how this links with the guitar festival is that earlier on in our program, we discovered that the agency where we were at had a bunch of guitars. And we're like, okay, well, let's get these guys in students' hands. And so we started bringing slowly guitar instructors to create a program that focused entirely on classical guitar. With time, we were able to develop a very specific pedagogical approach and a very specific exploration of repertoire and participation of our students in a variety of styles of ensembles, including classical ensembles, folk ensembles such as a mariachi or son jarocho. And the idea then was to grow this program enough that it could have its own guitar orchestra. And in the process, over the years, we came to realize that violins, violas, cellos all had a lot of opportunities, a lot of competitions, a lot of festivals, a lot of availability of activities through which they could shine. But there wasn't really a classical guitar youth competition, per se, or a festival that could orient itself to providing support to the young classical guitar enthusiasts in the area and to our students. So we decided to establish a festival in which we would bring artists, primarily Latin American guitarists, but we have had guitarists from China, from England, from just different parts, Germany. But we do have a strong focus on Latin American music and because the guitar does. So we decided to do it, but wedded to a component of a youth competition. And so that was the idea, to provide that and to provide our students with that experience, the experience of coming together with students from all over and competing with each other and then spending a whole day together, learning about the guitar, having master classes and different things.
So there's a performance aspect where sort of experts in the field, expert guitarists come and give performances, and then the kids are part of this competition.
Given the fact that we're in the pandemic and that most likely it should have been canceled, like most performance situations were canceled, well, we just didn't want to do that. We wanted to continue providing the service and to inspire our students. We all know now through and this pandemic just how valuable music has been for uplifting the spirit and just keeping people going, keeping hope going. And so this festival is as much an activity of hope and celebration as it is anything else.
Well, Dinora Marquez and John Ruiz, thank you very much for speaking about the concert, and I hope many, many people attend.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mayan, for having us and for just letting us share our story and this project that we're so excited about. So thank you so much for having us.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Dinora Marquez is the Latino Arts String Program Director, and Joan Ruiz is one of the instructors at Latino Arts. They spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver. Right now, you're listening to Renee Izquierdo, who will be playing along with the winners of the Guitar Festival competition and other professional guitarists this Saturday. For more information about Latino Arts and the Guitar Festival, visit WUWM.com. Tomorrow we'll feature an interview with local poet Richard Hederman about his latest book called Choosing a Stone. For today, we'll leave you with a little preview of some of his work. Here's Hederman reading a poem inspired by the streets of Old Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Public Museum, where Hederman works on the education staff.
This is a poem I wrote that was inspired by the Streets of Old Milwaukee Gallery. And something to keep in mind as I read the poem is that its historical setting is largely from 1890 to 1917, when the US entered World War I. And I particularly set the poem right around that time as the country was becoming very concerned that we were going to enter a world war. So there are references in the poem to war looming on the horizon and the concern over that. So this is called Streets of Old Milwaukee. It is endless, the early October dusk, smelling of smoke and lit in the flare of gaslight. The butterfly in the mason jar folds its wings as if under the weight of dust. And the draft horses haul their shadows back to the stables. In the alley, the black cat tilts his head in the dark, listening for a rat in the grate, a spider on the wall, or something else we may never hear. Even the films in the Nickelodeon unspool silently in black, silver, and silken gray, the actors gesturing as though signaling for help. The kite, torn by rain, hangs snagged in the wires. The streetcar reaches its vanishing point, as the barber summons his final customer, beckoning with his gleaming razor. In the saloon, the cards face down upon the table enfold their cache of prophecies. The Western Union messenger leans his bicycle against the fence. The gate is locked, the dead leaves scattered. Winter is coming, and so too a war that will strew telegrams from here to the Somme. Then the apothecary hoards his bottles, stoppered with the vapor of poppies. The player piano will jangle over the waves. The red service banners unfurled in the square will summon the clerk, the newsboy, the schoolmaster to Ypres, the Marne, and Amiens. So where then is the funeral parlor? The windows shut, the thick drapes pulled tight against the gathering dark. And where, too, the undertaker with his heavy gloves to lay us all to rest.
And Richard Hederman's poem wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of the conversations this week on Lake Effect, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear more from Hederman about his latest book, Choosing a Stone. We'll also learn about some good books to read as we close out Black History Month. And we'll tell you about the Jewish holiday Purim, which starts tomorrow at sundown. That's all tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.